welcome to CardiCast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. Our November Melbourne Cardi Party was hosted by the Paran Mechanics Institute and features Stephen Habey, General Manager of the PMI Victorian History Library. Stephen discusses the history of mechanics institutes, the PMI in particular, what they do today, and also gives an overview of his rather interesting career path. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for being here tonight. If you don't know me, I'm Justine Hanna. I'm part of the New Cardigan Cardi Corps. Nick McGrath is here and Hugh Rundle is here as well. So if you have any questions about New Cardigan and what we do, then please just grab one of us and ask. We are recording as usual, and we'll see how this one turns out. So if you do want to ask any questions, just bear in mind that, well, this probably won't pick you up, but if it does, come up to me and say, hey, you know that question I asked, can you just edit it out, and I'll do my very, very best to do so. Lots of familiar faces, but is this anybody's first Cardi Party? Yay, welcome, welcome, a couple of newbies. Well, we'd love to know how you found out about us, so do come up and tell us how you discovered New Cardigan. We are always interested to know the sort of ways and means that people discover us. So I won't talk too much, there'll probably be people coming in and out throughout the night. I just wanted to say, right from the beginning, a huge thank you to the Paran Mechanics Institute. We didn't give them much notice that we wanted to come along, and they have just been fabulous about having us here, and truly excited, I think, to see this kind of an audience here. of information management specialists, is what I'm trying to say. So I'm not going to do too much more talking, just to say housekeeping, toilets are that way, kitchen obviously at the back. If you are taking photos tonight and wanting to put them on social media, just be respectful of anybody else's faces that happen to be in them, and maybe don't post other people, except me, I'm fine. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce Stephen Habey, who is the General Manager of the Paran Mechanics Institute, and he'll be talking a little bit about the Institute today. We'll have a bit of a tour, and he'll also be giving us a bit of insight into his career as well. So take it away, Stephen.
Thank you. Woo! So firstly, a couple of things. One, can we all hear me? Because I tend to have a very loud librarian's voice, so which I've often used in to great effect. And secondly, if it's too cold, I can switch the air conditioning off. So just let me know. So just by way of an acknowledgement, we'd like to acknowledge that we are situated here on the traditional land of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri people, and offer our respects to the elders past and present. And we recognise and respect the cultural heritage of this land. So first of all, I'm going to give you a little bit of an insight into the Paran Mechanics Institute and the Mechanics Institute's movement as a whole, and where they came from and where they are today. So basically, they commenced in the UK, in England, in around 1799, with a person deciding that it was important to offer lectures on science and technological innovation, given that the Industrial Revolution was upon us, to mechanics, hence the name Mechanics Institute. Now, mechanics was a broad term used to denote anyone that worked with their hands, either, say, in a forge or shipbuilding and so on. And that gentleman was called Dr. George Birkbeck, and he developed the concept of lifelong learning, which is still in force today, and it is reflected in what was the old CAEs, TAFE colleges, and universities of the Third Age, and of course universities as well. The first Mechanics Institute was opened in Hobart in 1827. The building still exists, but the institute has long gone. Followed in 1833 by the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. That institution is still in operation, although the building itself has gone through several iterations over its history. Then the Melbourne Athenaeum, which is in Collins Street. They are technically not a mechanics institute, but we actually recognise them because of the work and the functions they've done over time as being part of that movement. They opened in 1839. And then we opened in 1854. And we're still in operation today. We opened before the State Library of Victoria, and we're actually one of the founding members of the State Library way back when. And the whole concept of a mechanics institute was used in the community as a way of actually establishing infrastructure. For example, a community would rally together to raise money to build a hall and then to attract speakers from all around the country or even overseas to come and give talks about the betterment of how people could better their lives. At its height in Victoria, there was over 1,000 mechanics institutes. They were either incorporated like a public hall or they were actually a library. Today, there's now 7 mechanics institutes still with a library function. So apart from ourselves, Paran and Melbourne Athenaeum, there's Footscray just near the railway station, there's Little River, there's Ballarat, and there's Berwick. And then there's some smaller ones that are coming back online after being dormant for some time. The Berwick Mechanics Institute is interesting because they have a very, very close relationship with Casey Cadinia Library Service, to the point where Casey Cadinia has a policy that they will not open a library in Berwick because there is already a library there. It's the Berwick Mechanics, and it's right in the centre of town. They, Casey Cadinia own the building, and the institute pays them the lordly sum of $1.50 a year. So, our first building was at 259 to 261 Chapel Street. The building is still there. That's what it was when it was first opened, but it is considerably different to what it is now. The original foundation stone is still there, and there are 3 shops on that site at 259 to 261. And we still actually own that building now, and that's where we get a proportion of our revenue in order to function. We're the, apart from the State Library and then the Library Act for the public libraries, we're the only single institution that has its own Act of Parliament, which was formed in 1899. It is still in force. It is administered by the Minister for Local Government under DELP. And if we wanted to change our constitution or any issues that are outlined in the Act of Parliament, I have to put a case and raise it with the Minister, and the Minister has to debate it in Parliament. The last change was made about 10 years ago. There has been talk amongst officials at DELP to actually rescind the Act and incorporate us either in the Library Act, which is used for the State Library, or to incorporate us under the Organisations or Associations Act. So we are fiercely opposed to that because that actually gives us something a little bit different to talk about with the members and the community. Our second building, which is still in situ, was built in 1915 at 140 High Street. And that formed the basis of the Paran Art School, which then became known as Paran TAFE. And then Paran TAFE was merged with Swinburne when they did the government policy of the time was to the TAFE colleges, get big or die. They merged with Swinburne and became known as Swinburne, the Paran Campus Swinburne University. The ground floor was the library and up above was administrative offices and other classrooms at the back. There were some changes made over time, including the removal of the roof at some point, because one of the secretary librarians was dismissed by the board of directors for moral turpitude and other such matters. And he refused to leave. He actually had an apartment up on top. So they actually came one night and removed the roof. And it rained. And it destroyed the apartment. And he eventually left. There's been quite a few eccentric general manager secretary librarians in history, as you can see. This is a later iteration, and you can see here the Mechanics Institute Technical School signage on the front. Interestingly, where that tree is, that was once part of the Swinburne campus. That's now been demolished, and that will form part of the new Paran High School that will be opening in about 2 years, 3 years. Now, we sold this building in 2010. It was an unfortunate shall we say, divorce between Swinburne and ourselves over the simple matter of the landlord not agreeing with the tenant on a range of issues, and the landlord being us. And Melbourne Polytechnic, which is the old Northern Metro Institute of TAFE, bought the building and bought the campus when Swinburne closed their Perang campus, and they now occupy that building. Now, it's got a heritage overlay on it, so they can't make any changes to the external structure. So then we had to find a new home, and we bought this building. Do you remember couple of months ago or years ago, there was a slight incident with a certain member of parliament who is in the Senate from Queensland about a plane that was misused for electioneering purposes? The person that owned the plane owned this building. The parliamentarian I'm referring to is one Senator Hanson. This building was built in the 1960s as a clothing factory, because there was lots of manufacturing around Perang in those days still. And then over time, it became a warehouse, another clothing factory, and eventually it was sold and turned into offices. So this is what it looked like when we bought it. And then that's what it looked like when we did some minor modifications to it. You'll notice that, like any new building, there are faults, and one of the faults we have at the moment is with our carpet. So please do not trip over it, because that would be most unfortunate. So we are now here. We own this building outright. It suits our purposes quite well. Any structure, it has its issues, but we're quite happy with it as our own members. So our collections. One of the things I forgot to mention was, over time, we were competing with the Perang Library. We're essentially another public library, although you had to pay a membership fee to join. So a decision was made in the mid-80s by the board to rescind their collection policy and focus primarily on Victorian local history. That, as it continues to this day, and it is a very successful reinvention of our purpose. So we've actually got our real purpose. We've now expanded that to include Australian local history, not just Victorian, but Australian local history. And so we almost consider ourselves a library of last resort. We don't compete with the state library or some of the academic libraries, but we have a lot of academics come to us for a number of reasons. One, they can access the collections more easily. Two, there's material that's available to loan that is not in stack and unavailable to access even off-site, as is it the case at the State Library. And three, it's actually a very quiet environment for people to come and study. So we have a lot of historians from a lot of universities, a lot of heritage consultants use our collections. If you've noticed here, we've got some archaeological relics from the Cato Street car park dig that's underway at the moment, and that was we had a display here and an unveiling here. The other resources we have is we've got a considerable online collection of databases and electronic records. Unfortunately, they're not available externally, so people actually have to come into the library and access them. We have the tried and trusted ancestry.com. We have archives and collections of other organisations, including the Mechanics Institutes of Victoria, which is like the umbrella group for Mechanics Institutes. We have the Cinema and Theatre Historical Society, or CATHS. They have their archives next door, and they regularly use our space for meetings and events. And we had an event a couple of weeks ago on the history of drive-ins in Melbourne, which was very well attended. And something close to my heart, we've got the Australian Railway Historical Society Victorian Library Collection here. It used to be located on Platform 1 at Windsor Station, but they outgrew that premises. They moved to 140 High Street, which, again, they outgrew that, and they came with us. And so their collection, even though it's a standalone collection, is being implemented, integrated into our library catalogue over time. And recently, another one to my heart is the Australian Timetable Association. I hear laughs, so that's all right. It's a body responsible. It's a historical organisation dedicated to the preservation, collection and research of railway, bus, tram, train, shipping and airline timetables. And they are doing a major project with the State Library at the moment to establish a national timetable archive, and they have located their collection downstairs. No conflict of interest, by the way, even though I am a board member of the ATA. So we have quite a diverse group, and they contribute in kind to the upkeep of the building and so on. And it also brings people in. One of the questions we had earlier this year was a theatre designer came in and was wanting photographs, drawings and plans of the Spirit of Progress dining car and the parlour car from the 1930s, because he was doing a set for a theatre production. So he went away laden with a whole lot of documents, and he was ever so thrilled. And he gave us free tickets to the play, so that was good. Administration. We have four staff. Myself, Ursula, as you may have met, and two others. Two of us are part full-time, so I'm full-time and Ursula's full-time. And Ellen, our collections librarian, is part-time. And Chris Moisey, our marketing and communications librarian, is also part-time. So in that in itself creates challenges for running events, because we have to make sure that we don't burn ourselves out over time. We have a board of directors. So I report to a board. It is made up of members from PMI and also representatives from Stonington Council. Now, just by a quirk of fate or a quirk of good luck, three of the members on the board are actually Stonington City Councillors, so including the Mayor, which is very convenient for getting things pushed through Council. So we meet on a regular basis, and we have an annual general meeting, and we have to prepare an annual report for the State Library and also for the Minister for Local Government as well. So as I said earlier, we have our income is derived from original property, which is the property in Chapel Street, grants and investment income. So we have some funding from Stonington, we have some funding from DELP, which we have to apply for like every other organisation, and then we have some investments through perpetual trustees. So we have a membership base of around 700 paid members, and these come from all walks of life. So our library management system is run by FIRST, FIRST is we're actually the first public library per se to use this library management system. It's not the best, can I say that, but I'll leave that to others to fill in the gaps. We are looking around for another library system, and COA has been mentioned many times. We contribute records to Libraries Australia, so we're an act both original and copy records, and we also participate in Libraries Australia document delivery. We have a lot of libraries requesting records from our collection that no one else has, so we actually are quite happy to participate in that as well. So activities, we have a small PMI press, we have a publishing house. Our last book was A History of Blacksmiths, and we try and focus on local Victorian history projects, and also niche projects that may not be covered by some of the larger publishers. We of course actively collect Australian history. We also have local history awards, so we put the feelers out to all the historical societies around Victoria and Australia and ask them for their members to contribute a piece of research, a piece of original research that we then judge and then give them an award and publish that on our webpage. We provide and support ongoing heritage research projects. We have regular events. So during the Seniors Festival, which was in October last month, we ran events almost every day. So that was the first time we've done something of that magnitude. And we have a meeting space for hire, like this space here. And we support volunteerism within the community. So we have a very active group of volunteers. We are trying to pitch to a younger demographic through the Duke of Ed program that's run through a lot of schools, and hopefully we'll be able to get some traction with that as well. So that's a brief interlude into PMI. I'm now going to explain the reason why I have this Hawaiian shirt on and talk a little bit about my career and how I came to be at PMI from whence I was elsewhere, if that makes sense. I've been at PMI since January this year. So when I was young, I wanted to run the railways, and I still do, because I think I can do a better job, okay? So we'll just put that there. My model railway runs perfectly. I started collecting things and stuff, you know, and arranging stuff in particular order. So Mum and Dad thought I had a hoarding obsession. quite possible, because particularly with timetables. I became fascinated by catalogue cards and those numbers on the top left-hand side. You know, what does those numbers mean? And I started memorising catalogue Dewey numbers. So 629, 385, the ones that I was interested in, mainly, you know, relating to railways and trams and all that sort of cool stuff. And I was at school. I went to Box Hill South Primary School, or Bentley West Primary School, then Box Hill South. I was the library monitor, but I had an issue with due dates. So I was often in the naughty corner for, you know, but I wanted to keep it. It was so good. But you don't understand the concept of a library. And those 10 years, at high school, I spent a lot of time in the library because I'm a nerd. And the school librarian at Wattle Park Secondary College, which is sadly no more, correctly predicted my future. He said, you will become a librarian, without a doubt. He said, you'll just continue your nerdiness. So apart from myself, the only person that came out of Wattle Park Secondary of any consequence was one comedian called Trevor Marmalade. I used to walk home with him. He was a ducks in 1981, he was ducks of maths in VCE, in HSC. Yeah. And he was a brilliant guy. He was a class clown, but he was very nice to me because I was a nerd. And he was also a nerd, and he still is. So then I had a choice. I could either go into transport planning, but I didn't have the science or the maths. And sometimes my dad said to me, so Stephen, you're managing a budget of like $10 million for PMI, and you don't have the maths skills. Are they quite sane? I said, oh, well, you know, if it balances out, you know, a couple of dollars, it doesn't matter. So I do librarianship. So I selected RMIT, and this photo here is a building, what was known or still is known as Building 22, but we knew it as the sewing machine factory because it was an old Singer sewing machine factory. And that explained the reasons why we had fire doors everywhere, because the floor was impregnated with machine oil. And the window, they had an early form of double glazing windows where they had the window here, a window still there, and another window there. And you can see the lovely proximity to the tram. So I often would have my camera and take photos out the window of trams going by. So I started I finished HSC in 86, went straight into uni, 4 years, and then I did my thesis on mobile libraries because I like mobile libraries because they're pretty cool. And also I could travel Victoria by train. So I did 14 libraries in about 3 weeks. And I somewhat got out of hand, and my thesis supervisor, John Adams, who was an inspiration for me to get into local history, said, well, Stephen, it's a fascinating thesis, but you're only supposed to do 30,000 words, you've got 60,000 words, so you've got two choices, you cull it back and you might get a distinction, or keep it and we'll give you a credit. So I kept it and got a credit. they were fun times, and I learnt a lot about libraries. It was interesting. Most of my colleagues thought public libraries were like, oh no, public libraries. They were wanting special law. Academic was the top, all the state libraries. One of them wanted to be a state librarian. Yeah. Almost got there, but not quite. But I was sort of like, well, public libraries are interesting because they bring people together. But I also wanted to get into archives and historical collections and stuff like that, and hence the State Library. So my first work experience as a student at RMIT was the good old City of Moorabbin, which is thankfully no longer. It's now part of City of Kingston. And they had things like photo charging. Do you remember photo charging? Do we know what photo charging is? Okay. See the picture in the middle there? There is a camera over the books. You actually place your library card and you open the book, and in the back you've got cards that are used 4 times and they've got different dates on them. They take a picture of the card and the library book, and you don't get a due date slip or anything like that, or a printout or anything, and then they process that film and then they methodically go through it and work out what items have been returned based on the volume of cards and the indexing of... It was incredibly laborious. They also had book catalogues. Now, I'm not saying catalogues like of books, but actually a book catalogue where they photocopied all the library cards and put them in Dewey order, subject order, title order, author order. And they were incredibly... They were about that long, and they were about 10 years out of date. They had branches on every corner, because in those days they had a philosophy, John Simkin was the chief librarian at the time, they had a philosophy that there should be a branch on every single, literally in every suburb of Moorabbin. So there was a branch at McKinnon, Bentley, Moorabbin, Hyatt, Cheltenham, then Clorinda and Warrigal Road. Of those libraries now, they're all. Some of them have gone to Glen Eira, so Bentley went to Glen Eira, McKinnon was closed down, the rest went to Kingston, Warrigal Road was closed, and the others are still there. It was actually possible for me to walk between McKinnon Station and Moorabbin, and to do the three libraries. And they had VCR and cassette tapes, which was all the rage, and they had no security system, so they lost about 30% of their collection every year. It was an amazing place. Very, very... And I'll explain a bit later what happened later, but then I went into TAFE. I got a call from one of my lecturers from RMIT saying, how would you like to work at Box Hill TAFE? I said, oh, cool, because I lived in Box Hill and I could walk there. So I was the reference librarian at the Elgar campus, 465 Elgar Road, and I was thrown in the deep end. I thought, oh yeah, I'm 21, I'm young, I know what I'm doing, and then I'm talking to these disinterested TAFE students from boiler making, hairdressing, the whole, and I was talking big sort of academic types concepts about how to use the catalogue and all the rest of it. So that was very interesting. Unfortunately, I was subjected to, the TAFE was subjected to a funding cuts, and I was out after a year and a half. So that was very disappointing. I then went to the Department of Defence. This is 350 St Kilda Road. That's not what the buildings looked like when I was there in the 1990s. The first building to the left is where the library was. It was downstairs, and there was also another library around the corner as well. The 19th floor was where all the main military staff were, and the floor went up and down like that. It was a fault in the design for some reason. So I was there from 1992 through to 1998, and I spent some time down at HMAS Cerberus, running the Naval Library there. I was on there for secondment. I was offered to stay on board ship, or as in on the base, but I declined. I thought, no, I need to separate work and my personal life. And then I got into quangos and corporates, even though Defence was a corporate structure and it was becoming more of a corporate structure. Defence Library Services, or DIS, was the largest library service in Australia outside of CSIRO. Now, they've cut back probably 50% of their libraries, which is an absolute travesty, like what's happening at CSIRO as well. So I got a job as the Information Collection and Organisation Librarian, which equated to collection development, technical services and cataloguing, at the Australian Council for Educational Research in Camberwell. And I had a staff of two, and we were responsible for pulling out the and indexing content for the Australian Education Index and a few other things as well. I then got headhunted to SCIS, which was actually a competitor of ACR for many years, and I was brought in to actually, I was the Manager Metadata Initiatives, which is a really funky title, but it doesn't mean anything. It's, I don't know what, you know. Anyway, I gave my first conference in Geelong at the at Deakin, and I said, well, metadata's like cataloguing for blokes, and I got a laugh, so it was, you know, pretty good. So one of the things I was responsible for was the SCIS subject headings, and this was my magnum opus, fifth edition. It came out in And the biggest thing was we included a whole lot of New Zealand subject headings in this document. So that required a very reluctant trip to New Zealand to work with the good folk at Te Papa, which is the National Library of New Zealand in Wellington, which also manages all the school libraries over there. So I was over there for about 2 weeks. I was able to ride all the trolley buses in Wellington, did all the suburban trains and all the rest of it, but also produced that. And I was very proud of that document, because it was to get all the feedback from the school librarians about what a wonderful tool it was really quite heartening. And I then moved into the Learning Federation, which was a part of Curriculum Corporation, to develop SCOT, which was the Schools Online Thesaurus, which was a subset of SCIS, and it was basically designed to apply subject terms or thesaurus terms to pieces of learning content for use in digital education. And that was a fascinating time, because it was all very breakneck, or sort of breaking technology and sort of using stuff that it was developing as it was evolving as it was being developed, as it were. And then over time, I went back to school, not to learn, but to actually teach. So I did some teaching at Swinburne TAFE, just across the road. How ironic that I'm now here and was part of there. So I did some sessional teaching in TAFE with the library technicians. I actually always wanted to do that, in particular cataloguing, because cataloguing is one of my passions. And I also went to Monash University and taught the graduate diploma students for a semester. And one of the students came up to me on my first day and he said, "Stephen, I just want to say, with no offence, but cataloguing sucks. It's so boring and I don't want to do it, but I've got to do it." But I said, "Okay, thanks. Thanks for that advice." He came back to me at the end. He said, "My God, you have given me all this inspiration, because your lectures are so good and informative." He said, "I still hate cataloguing, but I actually can enjoy it now, because you make it so like fun." And the irony is, he ended up being tech services librarian at the City of Yarra. So, and then I did some teaching at Chisholm TAFE, way down at Cranbourne campus, again with some TAFE students back in 2011. So that was a real blast, but it's a hard slog when you're working full-time and you're teaching. Mm. And the rule of thumb is, for every hour of class time, it's 3 to 4 hours prep time. Mm. And you don't get paid for prep time. You only get paid for class time. And I also was asked to go up to the National Library and do some, reprise my Chisholm and Swinburne lectures for a group of library technicians up there. So that was fun, except it was in the middle of winter and the hotel was so cold that there was condensation coming down on the inside of the wall. But that was a lot of fun. So, and then I got headhunted to go to Census. And people say, "Oh, you mean the Australian Bureau of Statistics?" I said, no, one of the commercial arms of Telstra. And this was, I'm now sort of moving further and further away from libraries. And I was brought in to do an indexing project with Yellow Pages, to fix up the Yellow Pages search, to develop a whole lot of taxonomies, and to basically look at their subject headings or their headings in the Yellow Pages directories, which I thought would be a lot of fun. So there was the Yellow Pages, there was Trading Post, who remembers Trading Post? And that was a lot of... It was interesting because I was applying library principles and archivist and sort of records management principles to these people that had no idea about sort of search. And these people were selling this to members, to companies and so on. So again, another book that I can add to my bookshelf is the headings book of the Yellow Pages headings for all the books in Australia. And that itself was a fascinating exercise, because we had to balance the needs of a company, i.e. Census, to maximise and leverage every single dollar out of a particular heading, and also look after the customer's needs and wants. So I then morphed into the manager of headings, rules and standards. So I became like a subject heading policeman, a cataloguing policeman. So I would often have to be in the middle between the needs of Census and the needs of the customer. So there was lots of discussions that would go on for days about the meaning of what taxi cabs mean as opposed to hire car services. Now, I can imagine just what it would be like now with Uber and to what dog walking as opposed to kennel services. But I made a lot of very good friends there, and I have a lot of fond memories. But I was missing the public library, and I had to make a decision, like, am I going to go down this path or am I going back to libraries? So I just by chance, I got into La Trobe City Libraries as their library manager back in 2008. I was reading the paper and I saw the ad and it had closed on the Friday. So I took Monday off and I rang them and I said, look, you know, humour me, I'm from Melbourne, not from Moe. So can I get the application in? They said, certainly, but we will consider others before you. That's fine. So I was back in public libraries, and I had a real blast down there. I had to move down to I had a young family at the time. My son was three, but his grandparents, he was half Italian, came from Moe, so Morwell, so it was lots of fun, but it was a lot of hard work. And one of the things we did was, I got that sign up. Churchill Community Library was a joint use facility. If you're in public libraries, don't get into joint use facilities, they do not work. Unless you call the shots and your library is not in the middle of the school. This was buried in the school and there were signs everywhere at the college saying, you know, trespassers will be shot and all that sort of stuff. So we built this Churchill Community Hub, and that was interesting because it was getting into library design, and we had quite a big budget and it was all greenfield stuff for me. So we called in, you know, experts like Rayco who... I'd say about their pricing, but it was an interesting process. We opened Churchill the day after Black Saturday. We did a soft launch because Churchill had been, or parts of the back of Churchill had been devastated. So we actually opened a month before we were due to open, just to have for people to come in and have respite and so on, and read the papers and just get away from the devastation and so on. And then it was opened about a month later by John Kane, who was the head of the library board at the time. And there's two of my staff learning the finer art of shelf installations. Why don't they teach that at university these days? I really just don't get it. So we had a lot of fun doing pulling that together. And just recently, Moe Library won an award. The Sam Merrifield Library won an award. Oh, no, the Moe Library won an award for architectural innovation. And then I moved, after some sad things happened, I moved back to Melbourne and I got into Kingston Libraries. And this is part of their website, and I actually came up with that read, live, learn, collaborate and experience. I was just tapping away on certain things, words, and I just came up with that and I thought, oh yeah, this sounds interesting for our new website. And my manager said, that's brilliant. How did you come up with that? I said, well, about 5 minutes work, you know. So I was there from 2011 to late 2015. I started out as their IT coordinator, so I was thrown in to look at their library system, which was AnLib, which is just, it just cuts it in so many different ways, not. And also we rolled out Wi-Fi, new photocopying and printing systems and so on. That was a real baptism by fire because I sort of tend to know IT stuff from the front end, not from the back end. And believe me, there was a lot of time spent in my office / workshop with PC boxes open and sort of torches and manuals and mates coming over to help me sort of rebuild a PC. And then I was lucky enough to go back down to Gippsland and I became the librarian at the Basque Coast Librarian at West Gippsland Library Service. That's actually not in West Gippsland, Basque Coast, that's actually in my friend's parish in South Gippsland. It's Poo-Wong Library, which is open 6 hours a week. But it is fiercely protected by the local community, so close it at your peril. But as things happen, sadly there are restructures, and I was unfortunately restructured out, which was after about 5 months. So that was, and then I was able and lucky enough to come here. So that's all sort of the things I've done in my career to date. And I think, get them young, that's my 4-year-old little boy, Dominic. That was taken back in 2009. and he's studiously studying Anglo-American cataloguing rules. It is a staged shot. But he does like libraries. He's a good library user, so, you know, Daddy's taught him well. But I can say that it's been a fascinating journey, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. Even if someone said to me, "Stephen, can you come and run the railways?" I said, "Well, yeah, maybe." So, any questions about PMI or anything else before I take you on a short tour? Oh, the Hawaiian shirt. Yes, I must mention that. Right. So when I moved down to Wonthaggi, where I was based, I didn't know anyone at all. No one whatsoever. So I thought, well, and I was quite lonely and thought, well, how am I going to get to know people and actually know that I'm the new library manager? So I thought, one of my staff, her husband is a teacher and he wears Hawaiian shirts. He teaches preppies and grade ones. And he said, I do that because they are so fixated on the shirt. They're looking at me, not playing, you know, with their pencils and all the rest of it. So I thought, that's it. I'll get some Hawaiian shirts. So Dominic and I trooped up to Morwell, to Lowe's, which is in Mid Valley, and I bought a couple of Hawaiian shirts and I started wearing them. And people sort of thought, oh, I can't remember his name, he wore a hat and stuff, but he was wearing this awful, awful Hawaiian shirt. So that's why I don't wear them generally here, but I do wear them to be, it was just a way of getting noticed. So, and it worked, because people, they would actually recognise me. And finally, Dominic and I were driving to a model railway exhibition, as you do, and there was a random bruise bus, and I had a Hawaiian shirt on, and the policeman looked in and he said, it was all fine, he said, are you sure you haven't been drinking with this Hawaiian? So thank you. What I'll do now is I'm going to take you on a short tour of the premises, and then you can...
I had a question.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
Fabulous presentation, thank you so much. You kept saying you were lucky, you were lucky, you were lucky, but I feel like there's probably a bit more to it than just luck. I mean, any particular advice you have? A lot of people sort of ask, how did you get a foot in the door? How do you get these roles? And just judging by what you're saying, it seems to me like you took a lot of chances and you said yes a lot, but you also had a clear vision of where you wanted to be. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Yeah, so I sort of... When I applied for a position or was asked to apply for a position, I would immerse myself in that particular organisation. So I'd find out as much information as possible to determine whether it was worth going down that path. I'd also do some blind shopping visits. So I'd actually turn up and just walk around, get a feel for the vibe and so on. And I check the local papers. If you go into public libraries, the local papers, particularly in the country, are a very, very good source of gossip and general council chit-chat about issues. The other thing was that I think keeping up professional development is really important. And I guess I've been very fortunate that I've been in organisations, all the organisations I've been in were very strong on PD, and I've continued that tradition here. So my staff get all the PD opportunities they want or are after. Sometimes there are some things that we did that we think, oh my God, you know, is this really useful? But after a while it does. And then you've got those opportunities to do all the networking and so on as well. And I think I was a bit reluctant for some things. I remember when I was at Kingston Libraries, I had a talk by a gentleman called Nick Anshin, who's a well-known railway historian and naturalist and botanist, and he wrote a book on Victorian railway stations and railway life. And I remember having to convince my management team about, is this author going to fly? And I said yes, and so I gave all the spiel, and it was a complete success. We had about 50 people turn up. And one of my staff actually texted and tweeted to say, look at this, there are 50 people in this room that are wrapped, and Nick's got them by, he has got them, totally engrossed. And I said afterwards, well, how did this go down? They said, well, basically, because you were so passionate about what you were wanting to explain in the meeting with your management colleagues, they actually got the picture that, okay, Stephen's actually talking sense. He's not just saying that because he thinks it'll work. He's actually we can actually be wrapped up in the passion and enthusiasm. And I think the other thing is, don't be afraid to try different things in terms of, if someone comes up to you and says, do you want to do story time? And you sort of say, well, maybe. You will get your feet wet, you'll make mistakes, and don't be afraid to make mistakes. I've made a lot of mistakes in my career. Some of them I wish I could, turn back the clock, but I can't. But if you learn from your mistakes and take a positive attitude, then that will do yourself a good stead. And I guess be proud of your respective professions. So we've got librarians here and archivists and so on. We have a lot to offer the community, and I think that the old staid thing, oh, you're a librarian, sort of, I think that's part of it, still a little bit out there, but there's now a newfound respect, particularly, and I keep talking about public libraries, but also if you're in that special library space, you've got a real opportunity to demonstrate your value by actually, participating in the research. And there's a lot of stories that comes out of the Victorian Government Library Service about how they've contributed a lot to government projects and initiatives through the dedication of their staff. So, any other questions? No? Okay.
I think everyone wants a tour.
Yes, all right, okay, so follow me. Okay, so this is the library. So those shelves there, where Neil's standing, is where the railway collection is. So that's in the process of being integrated into our collection through our catalogue system, which is a work in progress. We will keep it integrated. We'll keep it separate. We won't keep it integrated into our own collection. But it will be available for use by ARHS members to borrow, as well as our own members to borrow as well. And then we have our stock standard collection that go right back to the shelves over there. We have some display space. So some of these tables have got the artifacts from the Cato Street dig. This came from as a leftover from the open house we were participating in. These artifacts came from the good people at the Hawthorne Tramway Museum. Does anyone know what this is? We put this up on Facebook. It was our biggest Facebook response this year. People said it was a toaster or something like that. It's actually a resistor grid off a tram that bolts underneath the tram, and it helps control the flow of current from the pantograph or the trolley pole through the base to the track to the compressors and the traction motors, and then to the controller. And so they still have them here, but they often use this at the museum to say, what is it as a mystery object. So, so behind you there are offices. So there is space. We're a little bit tight for space because there are four of us here. We also have a large workroom called the Furno Room. Our other meeting room is called the William Moss Room. We've named these rooms after people that were instrumental in the foundation of the PMI. So, and then downstairs is the James Mason Room, which at the moment is used as a store/stacks/timetable archive. I can take you down there if you like, but it's just basically tables and chairs and lots of yummy timetable boxes and stuff that I rummage through. So we have, through that corridor and around the corner is the Cath's archive. So they have a meeting space about the same, a little bit larger than the space behind where Ursula is sitting. So they've got their archives there. They come in once, a couple of times a week, and they're actually open on a Thursday for people to come in and use the collection. So our volunteers use the Furno Room to doing book covering. So we're probably one of the few libraries that still covers books. We don't send it off to protect a book or anything like that. And Ursula is an expert, so she runs very detailed book covering classes for our volunteers. So if you're wanting a book coverer, we will offer Ursula for a fee of course, to come out and talk. Behind us on the shelves along the wall there are all the journals. We index comprehensively every single journal we receive. So we receive all the journals from the historical societies in Victoria, of which there are hundreds. And we also index the journals like the Royal Historical Society Journal of each state, and all the heritage, Australian Heritage, National Trust journals and so on. And they're all accessible on our catalogue. So the reason why we index them is A, no one else indexes them, and B, it actually provides extra content and value for our member organisations. Most of our journals we do on a swap basis, so we send them a copy of our journal, they send us a copy of theirs, but we also have a budget to actually subscribe to some of the newsletters and journals as well. As I said, our catalogue is on FIRST. It's available online. People, it's just like a normal public library catalogue, so people can reserve items. They will then receive emails. We haven't quite got to that text thing yet, but we will. We're still trying to work with a lot of our, and you'd appreciate it, a lot of our members are actually quite old. One of them is Ursula, Mrs. Rees?
She's 85.
Okay. Her husband was about almost in late 90s, and he passed away just recently. So she comes in almost every week to borrow. So we're still trying to work with them to understand that we can send out our journal electronically rather than printing it out. So we publish a journal 6 times a year, and we also publish a monthly acquisitions list, which we put up on our webpage, but we also email out to our members. So that's basically all the items that we've received in that month period. A lot of our collection does come through from donations. So we, a number of public libraries are weeding their collections, and they have approached us to take the collections on. So if it fits within our collection policy, then we'll take it on. If it doesn't, we'll retain it and sell it through our book sales. We have a very active friends group, and they run their book sales, two of our book sales for us, and they make quite a bit of money for us. And next year we'll be tripping up to Clunes for the Clunes Book Fair to participate in that as well.
Fire train.
Of course. Although I'm not sure how we'll get all the boxes of books, but I'll have to talk to V-Line about that. But we'll be doing that. So we have a reasonably healthy book budget, but as I said, we do get a lot of donations, and also from authors that local history authors that are quite happy for their books to be in our collection, as they would be in the state library collection and so on. So we're actually quite antiquated in terms of the way we buy things. Until this year, we had to pay for pretty much most things by cheque, and they had to be countersigned. So once a week, one of our committee members would come in and sit down with me, and we'd just write out these cheques and sign them. Now we've got a debit card, and we have to still transfer money from one account to the next and all that sort of palaver. But it means we can now use eBay, and we actually use eBay for buying quite a lot of books. And we can trip down, as you do on a Friday night, to Train World in Brighton and stock up on all the recent train publications that for the library. And I'll get yelled at by Ellen for saying, you know, you bought, but you can never have too many train books, I always say. So that was a very unusual way of doing. I've never been in that situation where we actually pay for most things by cheque. But that's actually in the Constitution, and in the Act of Parliament, that's how we have to manage it. But and a lot of other mechanics institutes operate that way as well. So we use the usual publishers, but we've got the freedom, because we're not locked into any major whole of government contract. So we don't have to go to James Bennett, or we don't have to go to Peter Pan or those. We can actually go direct to the publisher, or even just to a bookshop as well. So, and we try and support wherever possible Melbourne bookshops and Victorian country bookshops as well, which is very important. And they also will give us discounts and so on. In terms of our purchasing, we try and get 2 copies of everything. So we've at least got one in store if something goes wrong. But sometimes we'll have 3. So that's, you know, that's okay as well. So,
do you have much storage?
No. We are a little bit tight for space. That's why we've got a stack downstairs. So we've got two compactuses that are full of material that we regularly pull out and send downstairs. We don't weed on circulation. We only weed on condition, or if it needs to be moved because it's too big or we've run out of space. So our circulation stats aren't a big thing in our report. Because otherwise I'd be like tearing my hair out thinking, my God, what's going on? But it's about how the collection's used, and as in how people are using or accessing it. So one of our famous members is Andrew Rule, the journalist from the Herald Sun. He came in, he was writing a book on colourful racing identities, and he needed a book that only we had. And he was so happy he signed up, although he did forget to pay. But he did return the book and he handed over cash as well. So, as I said, we are a membership library, so we charge a small membership fee of about $15 a year. And also you can we have lifetime membership as well for some of our sort of more venerable patrons. Our youngest member is 8. He came in about 4 weeks ago to go to a slide night that we're running for seniors. And he was fascinated by trains and all that sort of cool stuff. And I was doing one on actually transport, and he and his mum popped in and said, can we, you know, we're not senior, but can we attend? Of course. So he and his mum joined up. So that's our youngest member. And our oldest would be probably 100. So we have quite a large spectrum. So next year, or the year after, the Paran Library is going to be closing for a rebuild. And there is an opportunity that we will hopefully maybe convert or use some of our space to have a pop-up library for Stonington, probably in the Moss Room, where people can come in and pick up books and all that sort of stuff. So we have a very, very close relationship with Stonington and other libraries as well. So there we are.
Wonderful. Does anybody have any questions for Stephen?
You mentioned volunteers. What roles do volunteers take in here?
Mainly, depending on their skills. So our older volunteers, they mainly do book covering. Some of our younger ones, we've picked up a few from Chisholm Tafe and from RMIT. So they're helping with indexing and doing some catalogue maintenance. So we're doing a major review of our Aboriginal and Indigenous collections at the moment. We're about to start one on railways, so I'll be looking after that. So it really depends on what skill set you've got. So Ursula is our volunteer coordinator. So what she will do is arrange a time for someone to come in, sit down, have a chat about what they can offer, what we can do, and then we work out from there. So, and we like to be fairly, you know, quite flexible. So, and it's, you know, the Thursdays here is quite fun because the volunteers are in and, you know, quite convivial and lots of laughter and stuff, you know, no shushing or anything like this sort of thing. So,
great.
Any other questions?
No. Well, we are going to be heading to the Paran Hotel for dinner and drinks and networking. I'm not sure if Stephen or Ursula are joining us.
I have to go back to Gisborne.
But Ursula, are you?
No, not this time, sorry.
Oh, she's come before, folks. Well, so if you do have any final questions, now is the time. Otherwise, I'm sure people can get in touch with Stephen via the PMI website.
Website, yes.
Absolutely.
Email. So, yes, and we're here. We're open 9, we're open 5 days a week, open late Thursday nights, and we usually open the library whenever we have an event on the weekend, so for our members. So yeah.
Wonderful. Oh, we do have a question.
You said you had 4 paid staff here.
Yes.
For the other organisations that are based here, like CATS, do they also have paid staff, or
no,
are they completely volunteer?
They're all completely
volunteer.
So
yeah,
they're all got honorary positions. They seem to they're all. The CATS group's interesting because they're quite a young group, so they most of them have taken early retirement, and so they spend most of their time here. The railways, the railway guys, they're all retired,
yeah.
And the same with the Timetable Association, so they're all retired as well. So.
Mm. Brilliant. Well, can we all give a round of applause and thanks to Stephen and Ursula? That was Stephen Habey, General Manager of the Paran Mechanics Institute Victorian History Library, speaking at our Melbourne November Cardi Party. You can find out more about the PMI via their website, www.pmi.net.au, and they're also on Facebook and Twitter. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'd love you to review us on iTunes. It does help other people to find out about CardiCast and lets us know we're on the right track. Keep an ear out for more CardiCasts. Check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events. And remember, folks, JFDI.